March 13th, 1977, Dunedin, Florida. The body of 54-year-old Robert Derschel is found on the floor of his bedroom with a fatal gunshot wound to the chest. A shotgun is resting on the bed, and investigators believe that Robert used his big toe to pull the trigger and shoot himself, so they rule his death to be a suicide. 16 years later, one of Robert's sons receives an anonymous letter from someone who says they are dying and want to confess to Robert's murder. Even though the Derschels learn about a potential suspect who might be the writer, the authorities refuse to reclassify Robert's death as a homicide, so the actual circumstances of how he was killed remain unknown. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and this week, we're going to be covering a strange and rather overlooked case about a suspicious suicide which was once featured on Unsolved Mysteries, the unexplained 1977 death of Robert Derschel. So as I'm sure you probably know, the third season of the Unsolved Mysteries reboot was released on Netflix last month, and one of their episodes covered the 2013 death of a man named Patrick Mullins, who supposedly killed himself with a self-inflicted shotgun blast while out boating in Tampa Bay, Florida. But of course, there were enough suspicious discrepancies to make his family believe he was the victim of foul play. Well, I'm certainly planning to do a Trail Went Cold episode about that case sometime in the future, but while I was watching the Unsolved Mysteries coverage of Patrick Mullins' death, I immediately had flashbacks to another case they once featured on the original series, which had a number of similarities. Robert Derschel's case took place in Dunedin, Florida, which is located near Tampa Bay, and he was also killed with a shotgun blast. The police ruled his death to be a suicide, and theorized that he used his big toe to pull the shotgun's trigger while it was lying on his bed. And yeah, I'm sure you can already see how problematic this scenario is, and why Robert's family believed he was the victim of foul play. Over the next few decades, there would be a number of odd developments, including an anonymous confession letter, and an encounter with an alleged psychic who seemed to know an awful lot of inside information about the case. But through it all, the authorities have always refused to change their original ruling, so Robert's death is still officially classified as a suicide. One of Robert's sons, Daniel Derschel, would publish a book about this story titled Healing Wounds, The Redemption Legacy, and it will be one of the primary sources on this episode as we analyze one of the strangest suicide cases you'll ever hear about. Anyway, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. Also, I just wanted to mention that near the end of December, our podcast is going to be releasing another special Q&A episode. If you have a question you would like to hear answered on the show, please email it to me under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Q&A, to robin.warder@icloud.com. The deadline to send in questions is Sunday, December the 11th. So with all that out of the way, let us now delve into the unexplained death of Robert Derschel. Our story begins in 1977 in Dunedin, Florida, which is located on the Gulf Coast of Pinellas County and is part of the Tampa Bay-St. Petersburg-Clearwater area. The town had a population of just under 30,000 at that time, and as a side note, being a devout baseball fan, I just wanted to mention that Dunedin is where my beloved Toronto Blue Jays hold their spring training every year. In fact, the Blue Jays played their very first spring training game here as a major league team just 2 days before this crime took place. Our central figure in this story is 54-year-old Robert John Derschel Sr., a World War II veteran who originally hails from the town of Batesville, Indiana. For the past 32 years, Robert has been married to his wife, Virginia Derschel, who goes by the name Ginny, and the couple moved to Dunedin in 1958. Robert is employed as a traveling sales representative for Hillenbrand Industries, a company which specializes in hospital furniture. The couple have 5 children, named Candace, Robert Jr., George, Guy, and Daniel, who is the youngest at 14 years old and still living with his parents. The 4 oldest children have since gotten married, and Robert and Ginny currently have a total of 6 grandchildren, with a 7th on the way. On the morning of Sunday, March the 13th, Robert and Ginny woke up and started getting ready for church, as Robert was scheduled to deliver a sermon there as the service lector. Robert spent some time outside, skimming love bugs out of the pool and briefly chatting with a neighbor, before he joined Ginny in the kitchen at around 7:30 a.m. Since Daniel was still sleeping, Robert suggested to Ginny that she wake him up for church and said that he was going into the master bedroom to apply some foot spray as his left foot was starting to itch from athlete's foot. Shortly after Robert left the kitchen, Ginny said that she heard a loud noise from the other side of the house, which she initially assumed was the back door slamming shut. By 8 a.m., Robert had still not returned from the bedroom, and when Ginny went in there to get dressed, she was shocked to discover her husband's body lying on the floor in a pool of blood. Robert had a large wound in his upper left chest, and a 12-gauge double-barreled shotgun, which he ordinarily kept inside a case next to the bedroom door, was now lying on the bed. Ginny let out a loud scream, which woke up Daniel, and after he joined his mother in the bedroom, she picked up the phone and called for help. The Dunedin Police Department and paramedics soon showed up at the scene, but there was nothing they could do to save Robert, who was pronounced dead. The police could not find any signs of a struggle or a break-in at the residence, and nothing appeared to have been stolen. So after performing an investigation that lasted for less than 1 hour, the Dunedin PD came to the conclusion that Robert's gunshot wound was self-inflicted and his death was a suicide. They did not attempt to check for fingerprints on the shotgun or inside the bedroom, and never interviewed any neighbors to check if they had seen someone suspicious hanging around the house. Needless to say, there were some logistical issues with the suicide theory. The bullet had entered the left side of Robert's upper chest and went downward to the right, which meant he likely would have needed to hold up the shotgun and pull the trigger with his left arm. The problem is that Robert had limited use of his left arm as it had atrophied from nerve damage. This made it very difficult for him to lift a shotgun in the air, and while the reach from the gun's barrel to the trigger was 30 inches, Robert's left arm only measured 26 inches. However, since he was found with his left slipper off, investigators came up with an alternate theory in which Robert did not use his arm, but instead placed the shotgun on the edge of the bed, stood in front of the barrel, and used the big toe on his bare left foot to pull the trigger and fire off a shot into himself. The Derschel family obviously had a lot of issues with this theory, and Ginny maintained that the reason Robert had removed his left slipper was to use foot spray on himself. Regardless, Robert's autopsy was performed by Dr. Joan Wood, the Pinellas Pasco Associate Medical Examiner, and she concurred with the police's ruling that his death was a suicide. Even though the Derschels did not agree with this, they were powerless to do anything about it, and pretty much moved on with their lives, until an unexpected event took place 16 years later. On March the 15th, 1993, Robert's son, Guy Derschel, received an anonymous letter at his residence in Clearwater. Even though the envelope had no return address, it had been postmarked from Tampa on March the 13th, which happened to be the exact 16-year anniversary of Robert's death. The note inside was written in big block letters and read, quote, "I have AIDS. I am dying. I must make peace with the Lord. I killed your daddy 15 years ago. He found me in his bedroom. I had no choice. Please pray for me." End quote. This prompted Guy to deliver the letter to the Dunedin PD, who agreed to take a fresh look at the case. They also provided the Dershowitz family with copies of the original police reports, which they had never seen before. While the Dershowitz found the reports to be filled with inaccurate information, further affirming their belief that Robert's death was not a suicide. I mentioned earlier that Robert had issues with his left arm, as 2 years before he was killed, he underwent spinal surgery in an attempt to relieve chronic pain he was experiencing in his neck due to an arthritic condition. While the surgery was unsuccessful and only worsened the problem, as it led to nerve damage, which caused Robert's left arm to atrophy and become shorter than his right arm. Since Robert was forced to deal with chronic pain and wore a neck brace from time to time, investigators theorized that this may have driven him to take his own life. Well, the problem is that they came to this conclusion based on information that was provided by unreliable witnesses outside the Dershowitz family, such as a nurse who had described Robert as being a quote-unquote bedridden vegetable following his unsuccessful surgery. However, this nurse had not actually seen Robert during the 2 year period between his surgery and his death, and his family maintained that in spite of his neck and arm issues, Robert still continued to remain a happy man who was able to travel, continue his work as a salesman, and maintain an active social life. At the time of his death, Robert was making 3 times the national average for a salesman, had nearly paid off his house, and had no debt or issues with his marriage. His loved ones described him as a devout Catholic who never would have considered the option of suicide. Another piece of evidence that investigators seemed to misinterpret was a note found in Robert's residence which was titled Bruce/Will, which gave them the impression that Robert had prepared a will in anticipation of taking his own life. In actuality, Robert had written the note months prior to his death as a reminder to meet with their family attorney named Bruce, who had advised Robert and Ginny to review their wills because of recent changes that were made to Florida law. The police report also erroneously stated that the note was found on Robert's bed when it was actually found on a notepad inside his office. To the Dershowitz's disappointment, the original crime scene photos were inexplicably missing from the police file and could not be found. The file did contain some sketches that the police had made of the scene, but the family believed that certain details were inaccurate. The sketch showed the muzzle of the shotgun dangling over the edge of the bed on the south side of the bedroom, while Robert's body was resting on the floor a couple of feet away on the west side of the room. When Ginny and Daniel first entered the bedroom in the morning, they maintained that they saw the shotgun lying on the bed facing east with its muzzle pointed at the headboard, which was the exact opposite direction of Robert's body. They theorized that one of the officers who arrived on the scene may have moved the shotgun in order to unload and clear it, and then placed it back on the bed in a different position before the sketch was made. The drawing also showed the shotgun's case resting on the bed over the weapon, and investigators suspected that Robert may have used the case to muffle the shot. This could have explained why Daniel did not recall hearing a gunshot and was only woken up by the sound of his mother screaming. However, Daniel and Ginny claimed that the gun case was not on the bed when they first entered the room and believed that the officer who moved the shotgun may have used the case to handle it in order to avoid leaving any fingerprints. The police reports also confirmed that Robert did not have any powder burns on his fingers to suggest he had handled a gun, and even if he was feeling suicidal, why would he go to the trouble of using his toe to fire a shotgun at himself, particularly since Robert owned a loaded German Luger handgun which he kept in a drawer on his nightstand at the time of his death. Even though Robert usually kept his ammunition separate from his shotgun, he had gotten into the habit of keeping it loaded following the death of the family dog, so his loved ones did not find it implausible that an intruder could have entered the residence, got their hands on the shotgun, and used it to murder Robert. While the Dunedin PD agreed to review the case, it turned out that their current chief of homicide was James Allen McKenzie, a former patrolman who had been the first officer to arrive at the Dershowitz residence on the morning Robert was killed and wrote up one of the original reports. McKenzie did not believe that the confession letter was authentic, and still felt the evidence supported the original suicide ruling, so the Dershowitz had no luck convincing him to reclassify Robert's death. However, the case took another bizarre turn in February of 1995 when Ginny's sister, Fran Bruning, shared a surprising story. Fran had traveled from Batesville, Indiana to Dunedin in order to pay her sister a visit before she hopped on an Amtrak train to Los Angeles to go see her son Bob. The train had made a stopover in New Orleans, where a young blonde woman who appeared to be in her late 20s climbed on board and entered Fran's compartment. According to Fran, the woman stared at her for a while until she finally approached her and referred to her by name. Fran did not know who this woman was, but was taken by surprise when she mentions the name of her deceased husband, Earl, and accurately stated that Fran's deceased father was a doctor named John. The woman then said, quote, "They're here with Bob," before confirming that she was referring to Fran's former brother-in-law, stating, quote, "Your sister's husband, Bob, and he was murdered 15 years ago." The woman soon introduced herself as Nancy Durham and assured Fran that she was not a psychic, but rather someone who had started receiving messages from the quote-unquote other side since the death of her own father, who passed these messages along to her. In spite of Fran's skepticism, she was shocked when Durham proceeded to write a long message to Ginny on a napkin in which she outlined the circumstances of her husband's death. Durham shared a number of accurate details, such as Robert going into the master bedroom in order to treat his athlete's foot, and his shotgun being kept in a case next to the bedroom door. According to Durham, Robert went into the adjoining bathroom to get foot spray out of the medicine cabinet when he noticed a stranger in the bedroom. After a brief struggle, the stranger proceeded to take the shotgun out of its case and fatally shoot Robert before fleeing the scene. Durham also recommended that the family seek the assistance of a quote-unquote competent psychic who already does police work in order to help convince the authorities to reverse the original suicide ruling. After the train arrived in Los Angeles, Fran introduced Durham to her son Bob before they parted ways. Durham left a forwarding address for Fran on the napkin and mentioned that she worked for a realtor in Maui named Moses and was planning to get married in Hawaii the following fall. Bob was so taken aback by the whole situation that he made a recording of his mother recounting the full story. Tragically, Fran would pass away only 5 months later at the age of 77 and never got the opportunity to reconnect with Durham. Naturally, the rest of the Derschel family were quite skeptical about the whole story, but could not deny the fact that Durham seemed to know a lot of details about Robert's death and their family history which he should not have known. In particular, the message Durham wrote on the napkin contained a passage in which she claimed that Robert had asked her to tell Ginny, quote, "I love you, be happy, learn to laugh again, see funny movies, etc." end quote. While this had once been an inside joke between Robert and Ginny, because whenever she went through menopause and had mood swings, Robert would often tell her to see funny movies. As you recall, Durham told Fran that she worked for a realtor in Maui named Moses, and Daniel soon learned that a company called Robert Moses Realty did exist there. When Daniel phoned the company, he received confirmation that a woman named Nancy Durham was employed by them, but she was on vacation for a few weeks. Over the next few months, Daniel left several messages for Durham, but she never got back to him. And even after he was given the phone number for an apartment complex where she lived, Daniel still could not get in touch with her. Daniel then decided to write some letters to Durham, asking her to contact him, but all he received was an envelope postmarked from Honolulu, which contained a magazine ad for a psychic spiritual healer, but no return address. In the end, no one from the Derschel family was able to make any further contact with Nancy Durham. But interestingly enough, another passage from the message on Durham's napkin turned out to be prescient as it read, quote, "The police wanted to solve too quickly and were wrong. It happens, but the new police will be correct," end quote. Well, sure enough, in October of 1995, 8 months after the encounter, the Dunedin Police Department wound up being dissolved, so the case wound up in the hands of the Pinellas County Sheriff's Office. The Sheriff's Office agreed to reopen the investigation and review the case by assigning it to one of their detectives, but they ultimately still came to the conclusion that there was not enough evidence to prove that Robert's death was a homicide. The Derschel family decided to contact Unsolved Mysteries, who agreed to feature the story on an episode which aired in February of 1997. However, while the segment was being filmed, Daniel was contacted by a childhood friend named Ingrid French, who had obtained a copy of the confession letter and now believed she had a pretty good idea who wrote it. Ingrid believed that the writer may have been a former boyfriend of hers named Matt, who had also been a schoolmate of Daniel's. Matt was still a teenager at the time of Robert's death, and had visited the Dershowitz residence on a number of previous occasions. As he got older, Matt had a number of scrapes with the law, and spent time in jail on drug charges, and for such crimes as burglary and breaking and entering. He also apparently had a habit of frequently using the word daddy, which is how the writer of the confession letter referred to Robert. But most importantly, Matt died of complications due to AIDS only a few years after the letter was sent. Ingrid was able to obtain a copy of a letter Matt had once written to another girlfriend, and Daniel provided it to the Pinellas County Sheriff's Office in hopes of comparing it to the confession letter. Frustratingly, the Sheriff's Office wound up misplacing the letters for several months before they were finally sent to the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, but the results of the handwriting analysis were inconclusive. When the Unsolved Mysteries segment about the case finally aired, a bunch of new phone tips were received by the show's telecenter, but most of them turned out to have no value. Unfortunately, the Dershowitz family would suffer another tragedy 3 years later, when Ginny passed away in January of 2000 at the age of 73, without ever receiving any answers about what happened to her husband. In 2010, the nonprofit organization, Parents of Murdered Children, connected the Dershowitz family with two outside experts from California who agreed to take a look at Robert's death. One of them was a San Francisco-based forensic pathologist named Dr. Judy Melnick, who concluded that the original suicide ruling should be reclassified as a homicide. The other expert was a forensic pathology consultant from San Diego named Dr. Harry Bonnell, who believed that at the very least, the cause of Robert's death should be changed to undetermined. Well, even though these findings were presented to Dr. Noel Palma, the deputy chief medical examiner in Pinellas County, he still concluded that the original suicide ruling was correct. Dr. Palma expressed his belief that if Robert's death was a homicide, the assailant would have had to fire the gun while holding it upside down due to the outline of the gun's non-firing barrel above the entry wound. The Dershowitz refused to accept Palma's conclusion, and in 2012, Daniel published a book about his father's case titled Healing Wounds, The Redemption Legacy. The family would experience one more tragedy in October of 2019 when Guy Dershowitz passed away at the age of 66. However, Robert's other four children are still alive and continuing to seek answers about his death, but the case continues to remain shrouded in mystery. So I guess you could say the trail went cold. So during the intro, I made a comparison to the recent episode from the Netflix reboot of Unsolved Mysteries about the suspicious suicide of Patrick Mullins. While his death has not yet been reclassified as a homicide, his family did manage to get his cause of death changed to undetermined. But even though I would say that the case for foul play for Robert Dershowitz is even stronger than the case for Patrick Mullins, his death is still officially considered to be a suicide. After 45 years, things have likely reached the point where the Dershowitz are not so much concerned with bringing Robert's killer to justice than clearing his name. After all, Robert was a devout Catholic, and since there's a major stigma surrounding suicide in that religion, I'm sure his loved ones want to ensure that the official record states that he did not take his own life. So while we're on the subject of Unsolved Mysteries, there has been a lot of controversy surrounding the Netflix reboot, as they have featured quite a few cases where a victim dies a seemingly suspicious death, which is ruled to be a suicide, but their families believe they were the victim of foul play. However, the issue is that some of these episodes have fudged the facts or left out key details pointing towards suicide in order to add more mystery to the narrative. The original version of Unsolved Mysteries also featured quite a few segments about suspicious suicides that may have been murders, but in retrospect, you get the impression that some of them really were suicides all along, and the victims' loved ones were just in denial, and created a false narrative involving foul play in order to help them deal with the situation. All that being said, I would still rank the Robert Dershowitz segment as one of the show's strongest examples of a case where the homicide theory makes a lot more sense than the suicide theory. Much like the Patrick Mullins case, it presents a scenario involving suicide by a shotgun which seems logistically impossible. And you certainly can't accuse the Dershowitz family of refusing to accept the truth. Even though they had a hard time believing that Robert's death was a suicide, they did reluctantly accept the ruling and moved on with their lives until the anonymous confession letter showed up 16 years later. Under the circumstances, you cannot blame them for pushing so hard for law enforcement to reopen the investigation. I mean, I suppose the confession letter could have been a cruel hoax, but why would the writer have waited so long to send it? Since Robert's death was ruled to be a suicide, it's not like it got any media coverage, so the only people who would have even known anything about it were either people connected to the family or the actual killer. If the writer was telling the truth about dying of AIDS, they may really have wanted to get something off their chest. So in many of these suspicious suicide cases, the victim's loved ones will often claim that they show no signs of being suicidal or depressed and had no reason to take their own life. And of course, the Dershowitz family have always said the same thing about Robert. The only potential motive he might have had for killing himself were issues with chronic pain in his neck and left arm following an unsuccessful surgery 2 years earlier, so he could have reached the point where he decided that the pain was too much for him. However, Robert's actions on the morning of his death do not give off any indication that he was planning to take his own life, as he was skimming love bugs out of his pool and getting dressed for church. And while suicidal people can sometimes do unpredictable things, there were no warning signs that he was planning to pull out a shotgun and shoot himself in a ridiculously intricate fashion. But what's ironic is that Robert's chronic pain issues actually make the suicide theory less plausible. The trajectory of the bullet seemed to indicate that Robert would have needed to fire the shotgun with his left hand, but the complications from the surgery caused his left arm to atrophy and become inches shorter than his right one. Furthermore, his left arm was so weakened that it was difficult enough for him to raise it over his head, let alone hold up a shotgun and fire it. I'm sure the investigators realized this, which is why they came up with a scenario where Robert shot himself by using the big toe on his left foot to pull the trigger. It's also worth noting that when police first arrived at the scene, they noticed a phone book lying on the bed near the shotgun, so they briefly proposed a scenario where Robert used the phone book to discharge the gun. But Ginny Dershowitz quashed that idea, as she claimed that when she found Robert's body, she pulled the phone book out of a nearby dresser in order to look up the number to call the police for help, and wound up leaving it on the bed. If Robert was feeling suicidal, it would have been so much easier for him to grab the pistol that he kept in that same dresser, but I suppose that if he wanted to kill himself in a manner which would fool people into believing that his suicide was a homicide, he could have gone to the trouble of using his toe to pull the trigger. Robert did have a $100,000 life insurance policy, which was not paid out to his family since his death was ruled to be a suicide, so that's the only possible motive I can think of for him staging the whole thing in such a complicated fashion. But the problem is that the evidence suggests that this would have been physically impossible. I previously mentioned that when the Dershowitz got to view the police file many years after the fact, all of the crime scene photos were inexplicably missing, so all they had to work with were the original police sketches of the scene. The sketches are available for viewing in Daniel Dershowitz's book and show the barrel of the shotgun dangling over the edge of the bed on the south side of the bedroom, while the outline of Robert's body is located on the floor on the west side of the room. Theoretically, Robert could have stood or sat near the bed and used his toe to pull the trigger and fire off a shot into himself, but the issue is that his body was found about 6 to 8 steps away. Would Robert have been physically capable of moving that far after receiving a shotgun blast to the chest? The other problem is that the sketches may not have been accurate, as Ginny and Daniel have always maintained that when they first entered the bedroom, they saw the shotgun lying on the center of the bed with its muzzle facing the headboard on the east side of the room. So they suspect that one of the officers might have moved the gun before the sketches were made. If their account is accurate, and the shotgun barrel was facing in the complete opposite direction of Robert's body, then there's no way he could have used it to fire off a shot into himself. It just seems far more likely that an outside party shot Robert before tossing the gun onto the bed and fleeing the scene. They always say that police should treat every death scene as a potential homicide until the evidence points otherwise, but here, the Dunedin PD did the exact opposite and ruled Robert's death to be a suicide after less than an hour of investigation. So if Robert's killer left any physical evidence behind, such as fingerprints, we'll never know, since the police never even bothered to check for it. I mean, I will concede that if this was a homicide, the circumstances are quite unusual, because why would someone enter the Dershowitz residence in broad daylight on a Sunday morning and shoot Robert while his wife and son were still in the house? Not to mention that even though Ginny thought she heard a loud bang, she initially thought it was the back door slamming shut rather than a gunshot, and Daniel did not recall hearing a gunshot at all and somehow managed to sleep through it. But it still blows my mind that the Dunedin PD looked at the scene and did not believe there were enough suspicious discrepancies to merit a more thorough investigation. According to Daniel, over the past 45 years, law enforcement has dreamed up no less than 7 different theories to explain how Robert could have killed himself. Most of these theories seem to defy the laws of physics and common sense, yet they still continue to push them rather than acknowledge the possibility that the suicide theory might be wrong and Robert was actually murdered. The original suicide ruling was made by Dr. Joan Wood, who was the associate medical examiner for Pinellas and Pasco County at that time, before she became medical examiner a few years later. However, Dr. Wood never actually visited the crime scene and made a ruling based solely on the police reports. She would go on to become quite a controversial figure, as at least 2 innocent men were charged with murdering their infant children based on Wood's incorrect rulings that the babies were violently shaken to death when in actuality, they died accidentally by rolling out of their beds. And while I don't have time to go into the full details here, if you want to delve into a major rabbit hole, do an online search about the suspicious 1995 death of Lisa McPherson. She was a member of the Church of Scientology, and after she died in their care, Dr. Wood completed the autopsy report and ruled that McPherson was the victim of negligent homicide. The church would be indicted on 2 felony charges, but the charges were eventually dropped after Wood decided to change McPherson's cause of death to accidental. This was a very unpopular and controversial decision which caused such a backlash that it prompted Wood to resign as medical examiner. But like most Pinellas County officials, she refused to waver from her original ruling that Robert Dershowitz's death was a suicide. The Dershowitz's would hire 2 outside experts who agreed to look at the case pro bono and ruled that Robert's death should have either been reclassified as a homicide or undetermined, and they did not receive any payment from the family for their work. Yet even though Dr. Wood was no longer around by this point, the deputy chief medical examiner in Pinellas County still refused to overturn her original suicide ruling. So I'm sure the Dershowitz's believe that trying to implement any change in this investigation is like pulling teeth. I don't get the impression that Robert had any known enemies, so I acknowledge that there doesn't seem to be any motive to murder him. But I do think there's a strong possibility that his death was a result of a burglary gone wrong, which would explain why Robert was shot with his own gun. One of the main reasons police did not believe that any foul play took place is because there was no signs of a struggle or any forced entry at the residence, but Ginny claimed that all the doors and windows were unlocked that morning, so it would have been easy for someone to sneak into the house undetected. Robert had spent the first part of the morning at the pool and in the kitchen, so when he walked into the master bedroom to treat his athlete's foot, he very well could have taken a burglar by surprise. If a struggle ensued, the perpetrator could have grabbed Robert's shotgun from the case where he kept it inside the bedroom and used it to shoot him. Hell, after Robert spotted an intruder, perhaps he was the one who grabbed the gun, but wound up being overpowered. The intruder may not have initially had any intention of killing Robert, but shot him in the heat of the moment. Given the sloppy nature of the crime, it's possible that if the authorities had performed a proper homicide investigation at the outset, they may have found the killer relatively quickly. The scenario I just outlined was presented by Nancy Durham to Robert's sister-in-law, Fran, during their encounter on a train several years later, so before I discuss the confession letter and the individual considered to be the best potential suspect, I need to address this whole situation. I'm sure I don't have to tell you that I'm ordinarily a complete skeptic when it comes to psychics, but even I have to admit that I have a hard time coming up with a logical explanation for Nancy Durham. The Dershowitz's pretty much said the same thing, as they never put much stock into psychics either, but even they were quite astounded by all the accurate information that Durham seemed to know about Robert's death and their entire family in general. To make a comparison, Daniel said that at one point, he tried reaching out to controversial police psychic Noreen Rainier, who had also been featured on Unsolved Mysteries, It was mentioned during episode number 272 of this podcast about the disappearance of Kimberly McAndrew, which I released earlier this year. Rainier told Daniel that if he wanted her assistance with his father's case, she would charge them $650 for the first session, which I'm sure was a major red flag. But even though Nancy Durham voluntarily shared a bunch of information about Robert's case, she never attempted to ask for any money from his family. In fact, even though Daniel attempted to reach out to Durham on several occasions, she never got back to him, and certainly did not profit financially from the whole situation. It appears that all she did was mail Daniel back a magazine ad for another psychic, so he speculated that Durham had decided she did not want to get involved, possibly because she was planning to get married around that time period and had a lot on her mind. But let's look at the circumstances of how this encounter happened on the Amtrak train. Fran lived in Indiana, traveled down to Florida to visit her sister, and was now taking the train to California to visit her son when she crossed paths with Durham after she boarded the train during a stopover in New Orleans. This is the main reason I have a hard time believing that Durham orchestrated a hoax, because even if she had managed to dig up details about Robert's death and the Dershowitz family, how could she have possibly predicted that she would bump into Fran on that train at that particular location? Robert's death also did not receive much media coverage at all until it was featured on Unsolved Mysteries 2 years after this incident, so I'm not sure how Durham, a woman who lived in Maui, would have found out about it or even known who Fran was. She had reassured Fran that she was not a psychic, but rather someone who had the ability to receive messages from the afterlife, and she also correctly guessed the names of Fran's deceased husband and father. The other potential explanation is that Fran herself could have fabricated this entire encounter in an odd attempt to offer her family false hope that Robert's death was not a suicide. But when recounting this story in his book, Daniel described Fran as one of the kindest, sweetest women you'd ever want to meet, and she certainly did not fit the profile of someone who would make up something like this. Besides, when the train arrived in Los Angeles, Fran introduced Durham to her son Bob, so we know that this woman actually existed. And when Daniel tried to track her down, he received confirmation that a Nancy Durham did work at Robert Moses Realty in Maui, so everything about Fran's story did check out, and I don't know how Fran could have dug up that information on her own if she was attempting to fabricate a false story. So I'm honestly at a loss to explain the whole situation, but even if you disregard the whole psychic angle, the scenario that Durham provided about Robert encountering a stranger in his bedroom who shot him does sound pretty plausible. So the only individual who has ever been pushed forward as a potential suspect is the former family friend and neighbor named Matt, whose full name has never been released publicly. I know Matt was still a teenager when Robert's death took place, but he had been to the Dershowitz residence on numerous occasions, had a criminal history which included arrests for burglary, and most importantly, he died of AIDS sometime during the 1990s. Given that the writer of the confession letter claimed that they were dying of AIDS, it seems like quite a coincidence that someone with all these connections to the Dershowitz family would succumb to the disease only a few years after the letter was sent. If Matt was familiar with the layout of the Dershowitz home, as well as the family's routine, he may have been under the mistaken impression that they had already left for church that Sunday morning, which is why he attempted to enter the bedroom to steal something. If Robert caught Matt inside the bedroom, I'm sure he would have recognized him, so this may have caused Matt to panic, and things escalated to the point where he grabbed Robert's shotgun from his case and used it to murder him. I know that Nancy Durham wrote that the killer may have been under the influence of drugs, and Matt did have some drug charges on his rap sheet, so he may not have been in the most rational state of mind when he pulled the trigger. Now, in Daniel's book, he was reluctant to flat out accuse Matt of killing his father, as he felt immense sympathy for Matt's parents. They had already gone through the trauma of losing their son to a terrible disease at a young age, so I'm sure they didn't need to hear about him getting accused of murder without any direct evidence. In fact, if the confession letter was a cruel hoax, one possible explanation is that the writer could have had some sort of grudge against Matt and exploited the fact that he was dying of AIDS in order to craft a fake confession letter falsely implicating Matt in a murder. After all, even though the writer said they needed to quote-unquote make peace with the Lord and clear their conscience, they never actually signed their name. If they were really dying of a serious illness, they wouldn't have anything left to lose by making a full confession at that point, since they're not likely to live long enough to spend much, if any, time in prison. And one part of the letter which seems odd is that even though it was postmarked and sent on the exact 16-year anniversary of Robert's death, it contains the line, quote, "I killed your daddy 15 years ago." However, there might be an explanation for this discrepancy. Matt's former friend, Ingrid French, managed to dig up a 4-page letter that Matt's parents had sent out to numerous people they knew to explain the challenges of him living with AIDS and thank everyone for their thoughts and prayers. Well, this particular letter was dated on March the 16th, 1992, which would have been right after the 15-year anniversary of Robert's death. So the Dershowitz have theorized that perhaps Matt or one of his family members wrote up the confession letter around the same time and were planning to mail it out, but for whatever reason, chose not to. They then decided to send the letter 1 year later, but did not change any of its contents, which is why it reads, quote, "I killed your daddy 15 years ago, even though the 16-year anniversary had passed." If Matt was too ill to write the letter himself, and asked someone else to do so on his behalf, this could explain why the handwriting analysis comparing the letter to other writing samples from Matt was inconclusive. Of course, if Matt was the killer, then he obviously can never be prosecuted for it, since he's been dead for 3 decades. And since this wasn't initially treated like a homicide investigation, and there isn't any physical evidence available, such as DNA or fingerprints, I'm not sure if there's any way to posthumously prove that Matt could have done this. I suppose that the only way to conclusively close the case is if Matt ever confessed or spoke about the crime to someone else, and they have yet to come forward. Even if there can never be true justice in this case, the Dershowitz have always believed that the top priority is to clear Robert's name and have him officially recognized as the victim of a homicide instead of a suicide. But while 45 years have passed, and the people who originally worked on this case are no longer in power, it seems like Pinellas County officials have no interest in admitting that mistakes were made and changing the original ruling. Overall, I think this was one suspicious suicide case from Unsolved Mysteries, which was definitely a homicide, and I hope that Robert Dershowitz and his family can receive official acknowledgement about this fact. So if by chance you happen to have any information about the death of Robert Dershowitz, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Also, like I mentioned in the intro, our podcast is going to be releasing another Q&A episode near the end of the year, so if you would like to send me any questions to be answered on the show, please email them to me under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Q&A, to robin.warder@icloud.com. The deadline to send in questions is Sunday, December the 11th. Now, the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. This past month, I released a special Halloween-themed bonus episode about the infamous Falcon Lake incident, where a man named Stephen Michalak supposedly came across a UFO inside a provincial park in Manitoba, which caused him to receive some unexplained burns on his body. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, cover yet another case from Unsolved Mysteries, the unexplained 1990 death of Chad Maurer. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Ale, Laura S., and MJH. Thank you so much for your support. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourselves a good week, and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. ¶¶